religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Universal Hive Mind. Today is April 30th, 2025. I'm your host, Nate Kapp, and welcome to the 74th Cubbyhole Podcast, where critical topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. The website for today's show is cubbyhole.com. That's CUBBYWHOLE.com. And if you prefer to listen to the show on a different platform, you can also listen with Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon, TuneIn Radio, Pandora, Simplecast, YouTube, Odyssey, Minds, X, BitChute, and much more. And just as I let people know on the last episode, you can go to Odyssey. You can find my work under Nate Kapp, and you'll see that I'm moving a lot of my material over there due to censorship and, you know, just to spread the information out a little further. So just want to let everybody know about that. And also, if this is your first time listening to the show, welcome to the Cubbyhole. And as I let everyone know, all the first time listeners, it's always important to go back to the first show and work your way forward. So that way you have a better understanding of what it is that we're getting into in the deeper, newer episodes. And also, as far as all the studiers, all the listeners of the show, welcome back. Appreciate your time and attention. I'm really thankful for those who have really gone through the episodes in order, and I really hope that it's serving you well. And if it is, I really hope that it continues to do so. And today we have Douglas Martin back on the show, so it's going to be a pretty big show, as anybody who has listened to us can imagine. And we're going to get into the nine pyramids dealing with Mexico. And we're going to continue where we left off and go a lot further into pure forms dealing with the Aten and Osiris. And we're going to get into double power or the double horizon. I'm really looking forward to going a lot further into that topic. And we're going to go a lot further into eschatology, which is something that I've been covering for at least the past 10 episodes or more. And we're going to start the show off with totemism and the advents of Horus, as well as Khensu Horus. This is a very big deal. So we're going to open that up, and possibly we're going to attempt to deal with some advanced material straight from Albert Churchward's literature at some point. So we'll see where it all goes. But it's going to be a pretty hefty show. And just before we get Doug on here, we're going to do a really quick recap of show number 72 and 73, because I'm really just trying to keep everybody oriented. And because we're bringing Doug in here, we're really adding in a lot more to what I've already been talking about regarding the Zodiac and the ritual of Osiris. So I think it's really necessary to, you know, make sure that we stay oriented with all the topics as we're going through these shows. So I just wanted to start off with show number 73, and then we'll work our way into show 72, but I won't take too long. But on the last show, we talked about Babylon and Neoplatonism, and this is a very, very, both of these are very important topics, very big major areas of contention, a lot of confusion surrounding these topics, a lot of deception. And, you know, this is really the veil that has to be pierced in order to go back further, because see, it's like a net that is keeping people from, you know, going further back into, you know, past this big 6,000 year wall. Okay, a lot of people are stuck in this 6,000 year box, and this is really a major issue when it comes to understanding the mythos, is people don't know how to go further than this. But we talked about culture and the confusion that surrounds culture, and you know, this is a very important topic, and the unfoldment. We talked about how the unfoldment is can be understood through symbol and natural law, but specifically the method, which is known as Freemasonry, or specifically esoteric Freemasonry. And we talked about religion. Religion is such a huge topic. So important to understand all the different types of religion, to understand that, you know, religion as teachings is so vital to understand, because we have to understand that there is an importance of the remnants of truth, the nuggets of truth, the kernels of truth that are in the teachings themselves. And we can't just throw the whole baby out with the bathwater. That's the danger. And so we have to differentiate between the religions and their teachings versus religion in general, because religion in general means to bind. So this means you know, to bind us back to truth, if that's what we're after, or to bind us from truth, which is to hold us back from going forward in evolution and consciousness. So just very important to understand this. And also we got into socialism and why it begins, or where it begins, and why it cuts us off from, you know, the real solution to, you know, our human condition, and just understanding that there really is no solution in socialism. Yeah, there might be some quick fixes here and there, but ultimately it is slavery. And we have to understand that if it is slavery, which it is, then we're just not going to, we're not going to find any real solution in socialism. Okay. So we also got into the spiritual prospect, and, you know, this is dealing with eschatology, and we got into sign language. And I think, you know, the way that we could sum this up in the modern day would be, it is the art of tracing out nature or mimicking nature. That would be the most simple way to describe sign language. But of course, it's a lot deeper than that. And we're going to keep on explaining what sign language means, because it's also dealing with pure forms and how important it is to get back to, you know, the pure forms, because we are in a world of fragmentation. The modern world is where we find ourselves so fragmented, and we must understand that we're living in a world of fragmentation. And this is what has really led to literalism, materialism, and socialism as a result. So that's what we're trying to do in the cubbyhole. We're trying to get ourselves back to the pure forms and understand how important that is. That's the whole mystery of Osiris. And that's what we're attempting to explain here and convey, so that way people have a better understanding of what it is that we're really dealing with. And it's a very huge topic. And I'm doing my best to, you know, really put it on the table the best I can. It's very difficult. But so this is dealing with eschatology, the study of final things. In show 72, I talked about the hero cults. And this is dealing with the stellar cult, the lunar cult, and the solar cult, in that order. And these are, you know, of course, the stars, the moon, and the sun. And these are what I refer to as the inspirationals. These are the cosmic inspirationals. These are the cosmic teachers that have, that humans have been able to take the information that they've gathered, the measurements of the cycles, the measurements of the sun cycles, the lunar cycles, the stellar cycles, and we've learned from these cycles in order to understand how to survive in the terrestrial world, the Earth. And it helps us understand how to be, how to become conscious, how to communicate with the Earth and nature, and you know, and essentially the whole cosmos. And so this is a very, very big deal. The hero cults are essentially where what religion was prior to becoming religion. So these nature cults are very, very important to understand in their origins. And these are the true, I'm going to keep on saying this, the true extraterrestrials that we should be the most, you know, concerned with, because these are the ones that are really, again, these are the cosmic teachers. These are the ones who are really helping us understand ourselves here and now. And also, we got into the totemic sociology, and we're going to get more into totemism today, and also truth, rejuvenation, mental, material death, spiritual rebirth, the zodiac. I'm going to continue talking about the zodiac as we move forward. The inner journey of the soul, that's what this is all about. Darkness, soil, underworld, the tomb, the womb, natural law, the crux, mystery traditions, aka mystery schools. The Little Bear, this is, again, Ursa Minor, the Little Dipper. You should understand all three of these because they are essentially the same thing, which is the Northern Circumpolar Constellation being the seven stars that never set below the horizon in the North Hemisphere that are connected to Polaris, the pole star. And this is a very big deal in order to help us understand the great year cycle, or the great winter, or the great summer. And we're going to continue to lay that out as we go. That's a very, very big deal. And also Osiris. Osiris is the central legend. He is the crux of the mystery of this whole ancient Egyptian mystery. And so he's a very important part and a very important component. And of course, Horus goes hand in hand with Osiris, because both of these elementals go all the way back from you know, the modern world of the solar cult, all the way back through the lunar and on into the stellar. And you know, that's what we're going to get into today. But this is also dealing with esoteric Freemasonry, ancient and modern. And, you know, a definition that I really haven't heard anybody else say about what esoteric Freemasonry really is it is a sacred geometric tracing method. And, you know, this is something that I'm going to get into in the next episode, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's something I've been wanting to talk about for a very long time. So definitely look out for that. And also, I got into anthropomorphism, which is giving human characteristics to animals. And this essentially becomes romanticized through different traditions. And we start to see how the pure forms become fragmented. So this is a very important component to especially to the solar cult, because this is where it starts to really happen. And so we're just trying to bring light to that. And also the aphanism. I'm going to continue to talk about the aphanism, which is basically the disappearance of the light of the hero, or you could look at it as the concealment of that light. Okay. And also I got into preserving and how important that is. I mean, that's what the cubbyhole is. And really that's what is going to give anybody or humanity a chance to truly evolve, is by preserving this type of knowledge or correct knowledge in general. So that was a pretty big show, number 72. That was, I'm really looking forward to continuing more on that. And we are, you know, in show 73, we did that. And on this show, we're going to do the same thing. And I'm just going to keep continuing to extrapolate on these hero cults. And Douglas is too. But, you know, show 73, it was great to have Doug back on, and you know, here we are again. So I'm really looking forward to this show, and it's a big deal. You know, this type of information is very difficult, and you know, we don't do this for fun. We don't do what we do on here for fun. We don't do it as a hobby. We just want to know the truth. We want to lay it out the best we can. We want to be as accurate as we can. And this is very arcane knowledge. So, but before Doug joins us, we're going to, I have to let everybody know that, you know, something that I've been stating in these shows, dealing with the third degree and the Zodiac. I'm letting everybody know that I'm reminding us of the orientation, okay? The direction east means, that's what orient means, is the direction east, where the sun first appears, okay? Where the light first appears. And so we have to orient ourselves, okay? And so this is the orientation that we should be in, just so we're aligned with, you know, what we're explaining here in this show. Okay. So we're currently still drawing, we're still pulling from the chest of the third degree tracing board of the ancient and modern esoteric Freemasonry. Okay. And we're using other mystery traditions, other mystery schools as well, just to put a finer point on the unfoldment. Okay, because you can't just find all the information just in one mystery tradition. Okay, and so we're in the process of remembering and discovering the spirit of true care in order to rebuild and polish and strengthen the modern pillar of today, which is all part of this huge sacred bridge that is barely connected to the ancient pillar of the past. And what we as conscious beings are trying to overcome and help others overcome is our neglect, apathy, you know, no care, and ignorance. These things are what have basically obliterated the connecting archway back to this ancient sacred pillar. And what these podcasts are really all about in the cubbyhole is restoring this sacred bridge back to its functional form, because it's about understanding that the better and stronger the connection is to the source, the more clarity and understanding of our own sovereignty, which in turn helps us get out of the condition of ignorance and ultimately the condition of slavery. And we're doing this as a correspondence in our minds and our hearts, and taking a lot of notes, you know, organizing ourselves and doing so in order to, you know, get it all sorted out so we can really see the bigger picture. Because it's all about putting a finer point on these topics and, you know, really seeing things how they are. Because, again, it's a refinement process. So this is our divine conscious connection with nature and our sovereignty. It is our direct lineage back to the ancient spirits, the adepts of the past, the raised men and women, the elders. And these are the people that have preserved this important, beautiful science. They've preserved this light in stone. And they've done this in, you know, through the passed down oral tradition as well, through the mythos. Okay. So they stored this knowledge in places that could be accessed. And also they stored this in places that could not be destroyed, like the cosmos, like the constellations, like the little bear. Okay. Because they knew man can, you know, become destructive. And man has become destructive. So therefore, we have to understand why that is a very key part of this big mystery of why they stored the information into the constellations. Okay. But, you know, the constellation that we're really trying to help people understand is the constellation of the little bear, because this is considered the symbol for the Most High, because it's the seven stars that never set below the horizon. Okay. So we really have to, you know, have our alignment to our North Star. And that's really what it's about. So in order to discover these preserved sciences, we are symbolically journeying through Amenta, the underworld, as a means of bridging the gap of this sacred bridge, and doing so through the, you know, the occult sciences that are stored in the esoteric systems that are found in the mist of Avalon. Okay, this is where we discover these systems in the underworld, and so this is the inspiration, because this is about going through the trials of the underworld, going through the Duat. And while we're going through the trials, this is where we are tested. This is where we are, you know, our behavior is measured. The knowledge that we bring to the information is measured. And so, you know, this is all dealing with natural law. And it's about continuing the unfoldment of the staircase, the sacred staircase, the spire ritual. That's what it's about. And we are symbolically sowing knowledge, bringing the knowledge, the right knowledge, to the information, and hopefully reaping more truth and wisdom in this sacred garden of the black soil, which is Chem. Okay. So we are filling the grail by demystifying the occult. So the more that we demystify the occult, the more that cup becomes full. And that's what makes us raise the spirit into the material. Okay. Even though they're at the same place at the same time, it's about becoming conscious of that. Okay. So just real quick, you know, I want people to just keep it, hold it in your mind. Put yourself in the shoes, so to speak, of the sun, the soul, okay? Because sun means soul. And think of yourself as the sun going through the zodiac, okay? Going through the houses of the zodiac. And think of yourself as going from, you know, going in the waning angles down below the fall equinox, down into the dark, down in all the way down to the winter solstice. And hold that in your mind, because what we're doing is we're in the area of that zodiac, of that tracing board, even the third degree tracing board, because that's essentially where we're at. Is we're going through the eschatology. We're going into final things, and, you know, where there is a rebirth and a rejuvenation. Okay. So we're in the middle of that. And this is a huge area that needs so much of our attention, because this is dealing with the Alpha and the Omega. And if we can become aware of what this is, we can keep drawing from it. And that is essentially where we're at right now in the cubbyhole. And we're going to just keep on going through that information until we really, really have left no stone left unturned. Okay. Because there's a lot to deal with. Obviously, you can't cover everything, but we're generally going to make as many important points as possible and try to stay accurate and try to get back to pure form. So that being said, welcome back to the show, Doug. Thanks for taking the time to make it back on, man. I'm really looking forward to diving a lot deeper into these topics.
Thanks a lot, Nate. It's great to be back on here with you. Looking forward to another show with you. And this is going to be a little bit more difficult in certain ways than some of the past shows. We're actually going to be dealing with some of the source material, and I'm going to try to demonstrate the difficulties and perplexities of some of this source material. I really like the way you opened the show up and explaining what we're trying to do, especially here today and everything up to this point thus far in the Cubbyhole series. So part of what we're concerned about is bringing more clarity to this difficult information, and at the same time, not further confounding these lost mysteries, because there's already a great deal of confusion. So going to try to just take our time a little bit for the sake of accuracy and try to demonstrate that, you know, while we are familiar with a lot of this difficult material, it is still perplexing, and we are in the process of fleshing this out. I want to bring attention to generalize the profundities in this difficult material to try to help inspire people to move towards this eternal truth and exceed the limitations of this dogma and this ignorance. And you know, that's part of what my ambition is, without further confounding it, but also, you know, make it it's advanced in the sense that we're into the deepest aspects of the anthropology, going all the way into the metaphysical prospect of the origin of religion, and trying to deal with some of the perplexity that has confounded the modern institutions we know as exoteric religion, and ultimately understand, you know, how these become powerful political devices in vestigial forms. And the vestigial forms, they do carry the kernels of truth. So in that way, their prospect is benevolent, because they're trying to at least preserve, you know, these kernels of truth that otherwise might be totally lost. But at the same time, this propagation of this dogma and then this imposition of not only the institution, but the state, you know, defies respect. It defies integrity, because the authority that we're living under is slavery, because it's imposed coercively. And, you know, we can't just reject authority, because we're at the mercy of the elders. But we have to, with our entire mind, body, and soul, reject coercive imposition of authority. Because the state is militant posturing. The police are militant posturing under threat of violence. The military is military posturing to force their view and their worldview and their, you know, slavery system on us by means of coercion. And that keeps us in a state of duress. And of course, they want to control the narrative. Their primary ambition is to control the narrative. Because ideally, the rejection of truth is a God complex because it seeks to be the arbiter of truth. And they're trying to exploit the idea that it's easier to believe something than it is to learn something. So part of what we're trying to demonstrate is the difficulty of this learning without scaring people away, and realize that many hands make light work. I mean, we're nobody special. It's just that we've been going down these rabbit holes long enough to understand what the barriers are, and, you know, ultimately realizing that this is where it has to go, that we have to deal with this cultural epistemological dilemma and all of the factors that have led up to this, which is basically, you know, understanding the natural chronology of building on foundations of pure basic forms that have the potential to endure the ages, that naturally will unfold in a natural chronological order into a complexity that will ultimately, in any case, reach beyond our own understanding, and it already has. So that's what the exoteric religion institutions are, actually, is, you know, it's a preservation of complex forms, but they are literalized and historicized, and it's a result of the anthropomorphizing of the types and the symbolic representations in sign language that were never understood by the Greeks, who had taken from the Hebrews what they had taken from the Babylon, which was already a corrupted Egyptian, and the Roman scholars have perpetuated this dogma into the modern world. That's what we're dealing with. And this phenomenon of literalization of these spiritual prospects or these metaphysical calculations have become dogmatic because the forms are so complex, you know, nobody can or wants to deal with them. And since they have been, you know, corrupted to a certain point in remote antiquity, there has been a long period of nescience, which means once it became so corrupted, we have to understand that the deterioration of these doctrines, it does correspond with the evolution. Understand that the evolution only continued to evolve in the Nile Valley. So Babylon being basically the most local prospect outside of the Nile Valley, is also a locality where the stagnation not only first is occurring, but it's most directly affecting and ultimately is part of the fall of the Egyptian. And that the science, you know, the point I was trying to make is that this happened in remote antiquity, mostly during what I consider the cult of eschatology, which is basically just trying to further expound on the perfected Egyptian doctrine, which took, you know, more than a couple hundred thousand years to develop and perfect into the eschatology, which is really the apex of the whole scheme of the mysteries. And then from there, the ambiguity starts in these interpretations of it, because the sign language is really only ever understood in the Nile Valley. And we do go through a long period of nescience, because, I mean, part of what I'm saying is it's really only now possible. What they had in Neoplatonism and Alexandria, it basically goes all the way back, or, you know, can be evidenced all the way back into Babylon. But Babylon predates the, you know, the full confoundment. But see, so the the evolution of the perfecting of these doctrines, it corresponds with the deterioration. I mean, they're happening at the same time. But once we pass the cult of Osiris, it slides into a total corruption, in my view. Then from that point, which is about 40,000 years back, there is nescience. So it's only now, really only been possible for, you know, less than 150 years, basically, where we can aggregate enough knowledge into one place to begin to restore these doctrines in their pure forms. And that also means that we have to, you know, restore the complex forms at the point where they're still tangible, which happens in the eschatological phase of Osiris. But that Osiris really can be traced all the way back to the earliest hero cult in the Five, and that these epigominal holy days really concerned how to fit a 365-day year into a 360-degree cycle or circle, and that in that way they were viewed as mysterious and holy. And, you know, most importantly, you know, marking the actual beginning of the new year, which is when the sun is at its farthest degree south. So if you live in the south, then the seasons are opposite of living in the north. So that's why we have to anchor to the sun at its southernmost prospect, because it gets very confusing and we can, you know, get disoriented very quickly. And then by the time we arrive at the solar doctrine, everything moves to an east to west prospect. So the Mount of Glory in the stellar ultimately arrives in the north and stored into the northern circumpolar constellation Ursa Minor. So the gateway into Amenta is in the north in the stellar doctrine, but in the solar, the gateway into Amenta is in the west. So that's, you know, everything that happens, you know, through this entire unfoldment is an endeavor to preserve this unfoldment and the discoveries of these knowledge, but also to provide a possible link that can be traced back. You know, so the more we understand that that's what these ancient cultures, particularly in the Nile Valley, are endeavoring to do, then we can better understand their culture. And then, and that way, then we can start to, if we can understand pure forms of a benevolent prospect, then we can start to understand these distortions and how culture and the ideas surrounding culture begin to deteriorate. So culture, as I've described in the three phases, in the first stage, it means to grow something. And then the second stage, it becomes a fire shield for infiltration by stealth. And they're still endeavoring to preserve vestigial forms that their priest class don't understand or their best minds don't understand. But in the final phase, it's coercively forcing us onto the cultural track of obedience and by coercion and forced imposition. So this has the potential to tarnish our respect for authority and the elders and understand what the importance of the integrity is and what is actually the general corruption in these matters. And it happened over a long period of time. The primary factors that are the causal factors are, you know, moving into complex forms, we're straying from source, we're straying from pure forms. So we can't deal with complex forms without these pure forms, but also, so neglect is a huge factor, but straying from source is the other big factor. So we can't just think of this in terms of some bad men, you know, lighted out of Egypt with these doctrines and enslaved everybody. We have to understand that these vestigial forms, we're either endeavoring to restore and preserve those, or they're being used as a means of a powerful political device to further confound and enslave the population. And part of what I think we want to help people understand is how this sacred knowledge actually applies and where the power that's wielded actually comes from and what makes it so effective, which is really a simple problem in the sense of we're not building on sound foundations. So those that can be made to believe in absurdities can be made to commit atrocities. So everybody, you know, these civilizations that have committed these atrocities in the past all the way into the present, most of them have done so believing that their endeavors were genuinely benevolent. And the mantra was, you know, basically God wills it, or Deus vult. And they genuinely believe that they were doing something benevolent. And that's what we're witnessing. I mean, these coercive institutions, such as the police and military, they believe they are benevolent, and they don't understand how the oppression of the state is controlling a narrative and therefore endeavoring to obliterate any evidence or information that would challenge their official story, and that this knowledge could get obliterated into oblivion, which some of it already has. And we don't know the extent of it, but, you know, I wouldn't be on here if I didn't feel like there was enough to restore and help preserve the purest forms that we can attain to. Because it's really only after J. Norman Lockyer's book in the late 19th century that we can exceed Champollion and Wallace Budge. And it has to do with the orientation of the temples. And that gives rise to Gerald Massey, the great Egyptologist. But there's a limitation in his work because he's not really genuinely an initiate in the mystery schools, but Albert Churchward's work builds on the genius of Gerald Massey's work and unlocks the deeper mysteries that Massey has fleshed out and provided a good chronology for. I think one of the things that I've found in studying the Massey is basically that this solar phase of this unfoldment of the mysteries and the different phases of the Egyptian cults is that it demonstrates that this solar phase has been in existence for a long period of time, which we've kind of tried to pin down to about 100,000 years, and that the solar phase is much more complex because it's going into anthropomorphic forms and more complex forms, and then, you know, elemental powers are further broken down and then represented not only in different types, but anthropomorphized types, to where they begin to be romanticized and characterized and humanized and then literalized and historicized. And there's a term, you know, because we not only have the literalization of, you know, spiritual concepts and spiritual prospects and ancient wisdom has not only been distorted in the form of literalization and historization. There's a term called euhemerism, which is also basically making the assumption that the mythology is a distortion of actual historical events. So it's kind of the same thing in reverse. So euhemerism is a phenomenon too that we're dealing with. And but, you know, part of what we want to do on the show today is to at least demonstrate the difficulties, because, like I said, I wouldn't be on here and I would have no interest in you know, being active publicly if I really didn't feel like I was bringing something that was imperative that was being left out. And but what I don't want to do is further confound it with conjecture and speculation. And the speculation, you know, it's necessary in the gestalt to, you know, flesh out some of these deeper concepts. But also we need to adhere to, you know, what the original purpose of these forms are. So, you know, we started talking about totemism in the last show. And it's a difficult subject because it's perplexing. And but see, it becomes an essential part of the study. So we're not really going to be able to flesh out the unfoldment of the mythos and the evolution of the mythos without a better understanding of this totemism and the phenomenon of sign language and a representation. You know, this representative form of natural phenomenon or phenomena. And, that's a lot of what it is. So yeah, let me hand that back over to you.
Yeah. There's a lot to
figure out how we can start out on this.
Yeah. A lot to unpack. And I really appreciate everything you just said. And, since you just ended with totemism, I think it'd be good to continue talking about that, because I know you wanted to talk about further defining that term. And I think that's really, really important to define that term and help people understand the deeper workings of totemism, why it's so important to the ancient Egyptian mythos, and you know, how does it really help us communicate with nature?
I brought along a standard definition for the word, so I'll give that now. Totem is a noun, and it means a natural object or animal that is believed by a particular society to have spiritual significance, and that is adopted by it as an emblem. So the emblem becomes a totemic form of a spiritual significance. And then, you know, because one of the big controversies and contentions in the church world in particular is Sir James George Frazer's work, which is The Golden Bough, and that's an encyclopedia of culture. And but Frazer, you know, and it's very voluminous. So it's a very important body of work. However, Frazer's conclusions, you know, about this documentation, I would take umbrage with, or I have a contention with, and Churchward does as well. One of these things is the idea that magic and fetishism, or particularly magic, predating religion. And that's a logical fallacy. It's erroneous because we have the evidence to understand that the religious prospect predates the magic, and that's important because the magic leads to the fetishism, which really leads us into a type of a material prospect. And a lot of the confusion is about confusing a symbol or an emblem for what it actually symbolically represents. And then it corresponds to this phenomenon of literalizing things that we don't understand, and materializing things that we don't understand, and degrading the profundities of the spiritual prospect. Because, you know, the whole idea of the initiation is dealing with the spiritual passage of the manes through the underworld, and the journey of the ka, or the spirit soul, through the underworld, the ka being the highest prospect for the human soul. And you know, the forms of representation being deteriorated. Another with basic definitions that I brought for totem was totemism actually is a person or a thing regarded as being symbolic or representative of a particular quality or concept. So those are the basic ideas of a totem and then totemism in its application. But let me try to explain this a little bit because I know it's confusing. And I can barely, you know, grasp it for myself to try to expedite this into an understanding. But in the totemic sociology, it's understood that breeding too close to the tribe could cause birth defects. So part of, you know, and all this predates language. So the sign language is a primitive form of finding ways to express symbolically. The irony of that is that it actually, even though it's our most primitive form of communication and preserving and communicating knowledge, it becomes superior to modern communication because the whole brain has to be engaged and a deeper knowledge of elementals is required. And because the language and the alphabetization is causing a deterioration in the symbolism. So by being able to, you know, we have to understand that the idea of a symbol is potentially inexhaustible. So we're talking about basic archetypes. They're immediately in their discovery being spiritualized in the sense that they're preserving a deep knowledge that reaches into a more remote antiquity. So it constitutes a body of knowledge that's taken longer to develop and understand and pass forward. That's a difficult thing. So, you know, this idea of breeding too close to the tribe, the members of the tribe could be each assigned a different totem or representative animal form as a symbol of themselves as a member of that particular tribe. So if you have a female that has been designated the totem of lizard, for instance, then all of her offspring or progeny would be lizards as a way of distinguishing one tribe from the other. And that's just something I'm putting on the table so we can understand that these symbols, these totemic forms are not divinized at this point. But once they become divinized, they could be erected into a pillar form with a grounded type surmounted by an arboreal type. So a terrestrial animal, you know, mounted by a bird. You know, a snake in the claws of an eagle or a hawk. But in a totem pole, the point I'm trying to make is that typifies where these totems are being applied and divinized. So that's a more advanced form coming out of the totemic sociology. And it denotes the origin of religion, which I want to put the emphasis on, predates magic. So first, the ancients propitiated elemental powers, and that's a prospect for forces in nature beyond the control of man and you know, a higher authority in the world above man's authority, and it's a rejection of man's authority in that respect. That these things exist eternally throughout the universe. It's a prospect for natural law and understanding the effects of these hidden forces.
Well, let me real quick. I just want to ask you something just because this is very interesting what you're saying. And I want to know more about what you mean by magic, or like, what do you mean by magic? And also, Why would magic only exist once religion begins and not before?
Because magic is basically trying to influence these elemental powers.
Mm.
Okay, so the concept of ancestry first propitiating elemental powers, then propitiating ancestry, and ultimately propitiating the one great spirit in that order is part of the evidence that the magic does not exist before the acknowledgement of these powers and of the acknowledgement of the concern for the Ka, which is the highest expression or highest prospect for the human soul. And so the idea of the magic is to try to influence these elemental powers. And the idea of the origin of religion is an acknowledgement of this prospect for a higher authority or a higher power than man. So the magic ultimately is deteriorated into fetishism, where the adoration of the object representing the Ka becomes the object of adoration, and its symbolic representation begins to deteriorate, and then we don't understand its full significance. That's one of the phenomena that happens in the solar phase, is the sun symbolically represents the one great spirit, but ultimately the symbol itself becomes the object of adoration, and it's no longer understood that it what it symbolically represented. So it leads to this literal, you know, material prospect and this disc worship, which is pentacle, and it's part of the slide into materialism. So you know, these are very difficult topics.
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, what can you further elaborate on propitiation, what that really means?
Well, it's basically veneration.
Veneration. Okay.
You know, so it would be in sign language and totemic.
Right. Like holding something in high regard, something pure.
Making an offering.
And
a burial to try to influence elemental powers to guide the manes of the ancestor through the underworld, and have the forces in nature help in that journey of the spiritual passage through this underworld prospect. And then ultimately, you know, eternal life, eternal resurrection, rather than, you know, the total annihilation of the soul. And yeah, it's a difficult thing to explain, because I'm not exactly sure. I wasn't exactly sure how well I was going to be able to do with this. I just wanted to make sure that we started to discuss it and try to get it on the table. But I'm making, you know, certain points about it, and try to bring that more into an understanding of the unfoldment of the sacred knowledge. So we have to understand in totemic sociology that they venerate the dual motherhood, and that the masculine prospect of the fatherhood, I mean, I'm going to say it's reserved for the third degree, which was really basically represented by the solar phase. And that's a third degree prospect. So that's hard to understand, I realize, but let me just say this. In totemism, first comes the natural fact, then the mythical representation, and then lastly, the eschatological application, and all three phases have to be studied and collated and compared for this purpose.
And you could do that with stellar, lunar, and solar? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that stellar, lunar, and solar could correspond to the three degrees, which corresponds to the development of human in the mortal life in three stages. So that would be infancy, adolescence, and maturity.
Right.
And in the unfoldment of the knowledge, the stellar, lunar, and solar would represent infancy, adolescence, and maturity in the scheme of the human development and the human story. So in totemism, the dual motherhood is followed by the dual brotherhood, which is Horus and Set, represented in the primary mythology as the twin brothers, the first two heroes of the hero cult, and then followed by Shu, which is the raising of the linear prospect of duality into a three-dimensional primary trinity of the stellar hero cult. So I realize that's difficult to hear and understand, but I'm getting it on the table now so we can deal with it. And so we want to understand that to me, it means they're being cautious about the masculine prospect, and that the third degree in the evolution of the mythos and the third degree of the Masonic tradition, it deals with not only the eschatology, but also maturity in life. And it's a mature phase, which involves mastery over the masculine prospect. That the masculine prospect is a primary danger, because the nature of the masculine is to dominate. The nature of the masculine is penetrative, and the nature of the masculine is, you know, primarily dominating, but forceful. So
this is the whole.
Yeah, go ahead. And
this is the whole point of primacy in the North, because it's,
yeah, that's right. I mean, the pyramids were built as a record that the stellar mythology differs from what's going to come after, and that their timekeeping concerns the great year cycle, which is measured in the circumpolar constellation, starting in the south and then ultimately moving and being stored in the northern circumpolar constellations. So the Mount of Heaven in the stellar is in the north. So the entrance to the Amenta in the north, which is into the underworld, is in the north in the stellar, but in the solar, it's in the west. So the Mount of Heaven in the solar is in the west, and the entrance is in the west. And that's a hard thing to understand. It's hard for me to say it, but I'm glad I'm getting it on the table now. We can start trying to flesh this out, because I definitely have some good points to make. And I wasn't really sure what this is going to sound like coming out rhetorically or in the rhetoric, but it's difficult. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I really like that you're bringing this up, because, you know, when it comes to the mount, I understand the mount can only, you know, especially when you're talking about Shu in the solar, the mount is, you know, you have the south and the north in equal poise. And therefore, it's interesting because Shu, the symbol of Shu that I've seen, he is on one knee in the solar. And in the stellar, he is fully raised. He is fully holding up Newt, and he's not on one knee under Newt in that regard.
That's right, because in the stellar, they're preserving the dual motherhood that precedes the hero cult, you know, as a means of finding our way back. But the point I was trying to make is the idea of Horus and Set in anthropomorphic forms becomes confusing, because as we can see, this predates the parents, in the sense of there is no father. Even though Osiris is brought on in the stellar phase, the masculine is never divinized in the stellar phase. So it gets very confusing.
Yeah, Yeah, it is. It's very, very difficult and obscure. And there's a few things I wanted to say. One is I just, you know, I was thinking about this correspondence with the horseshoe. And the horseshoe is very interesting because, you know, if you look at all the nails on a horseshoe, that can look like the stars of Newt, right? And yeah. And a horseshoe is also, you know, this is something that man has used as a form of utility for the past, you know, 2,500 years plus. And this is a way for man to, you know, be more mobile and go and further places geographically. And it's interesting because the horse in today's world, or even in the past, you know, 300 years, when we think of the West world, or the when we think of westing, and we have a horse with a cowboy, you know, this is symbolic, as you've stated, but, you know, with a bull, not a horse. But the point is, you know, the cowboy figure or archetype is associated with westing. And
that's right.
And this is, you know, so this is under the solar cult umbrella. And the thing that I wanted to say, though, is when you look at the horseshoe, I find it interesting that you know, this is the arc, right? This is the arc of the sun, and also
waxing and waning angles.
The waxing and waning angles of the sun in an arc. And
yeah.
And so you have, you know, horseshoe is Horus shoe. That's the green language, right? And
yeah.
And then, you know, where the shoe comes down, where the two points come down, I would say, you know, this has a lot to do with Sut or Set, because you're basically dealing with that space in between the two points at the bottom of the shoe. This would be where the sun rests. From in the eschatology, from point to point.
Yeah.
And you know, also,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot more to that. You could even flip it upside down as the U, you know. Yeah, that's a big correspondence that I was thinking about regarding Shu raising the horizon, that's stored as an emblem, you know, on the bottom of a horse foot, on the sole of a horse, even.
That's right. Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's interesting. And I want to just, you know, point out that the horse is an anagram for Horus, basically, alphabetically. And that the horse was actually basically the last type that was divinized as a form of Horus in all his different phases, which can be traced all the way back to the earliest hero cult in the stellar phase. And also the horse, in my experience, is significant because, you know, you've heard me say that the way back is through Britain and pre-Roman Britain, and there they have symbolism that is sacred and being preserved that can, and the horse is a big part of that, and can be traced back to Chaldea, which represents basically the prehistoric world, but posterior to the corruption of, you know, the perfected eschatology. So that's, I know it's a hard thing to say and understand, but at least I've put it on the table now. And I was kind of interested in trying to show some of the diagrams of what was found in Augustus Laplanjian's expedition in Mexico, and how these early forms from the original stellar trinity in Horus, Sut, and Shu were evolved into the five from the three and in the stellar phase. And so we have to understand, once the stellar trinity has evolved into the five, we're dealing with the gods of the four corners, with Osiris at the spiritual center. So it's pure animism. and that these four corners in the modern world is basically Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So we can see that that is a fully anthropomorphized, historicized, literalized, euhemerized form of these very early ancient forms, and it's about the God of the four corners. So we talk about the word corner. It's similar to coroner. It's dealing with death. Ideally, it's the house of Anoop, which typifies the physical realm. But what it's really doing is trying to explicitly preserve that five in the spiritual center. But understand that the square represents the physical realm, But the point of it is to understand that we place the triangle on top of the square because the spiritual prospect is a higher prospect. But the fact that the five takes place in the stellar phase, the original stellar trinity takes primacy over that. And that five at that point is a speculative prospect for the eschatology. So it's basically reserved for the very high initiate speculative priest class, and carried forward, through the lunar, and then really fully developed and unlocked in about the middle of the solar phase, which is about 50,000 years ago during the cult of Osiris. So that represents the point of the perfected eschatology, which means that everything that follows that is potentially a decline. It's a downgrade, which moves us all the way into socialism and materialism and dogma. So there's a lot more to that. Part of what we're talking about is really discovering our highest prospect of a purpose of a mortal life, and the highest prospect for the perfection of the human soul in its most divine aspect. That's kind of what we're dealing with here. So it's a hard thing to say, and it's a hard thing to understand.
I want to ask you a question about, I want to further refine what you mean by Osiris being held back in the five or in the X. I think this is really significant. And, you've talked about how Osiris comes, was in the stellar and then comes through the lunar into the solar. What does this really, really deeply mean, and how does this work? How did you figure this out?
Yeah, it's a difficult prospect, but like I was talking about in the totemic sociology, going into the hero cult, the idea of the totems becoming more significant in the sense of being divinized, the idea of the stack of the one on top of the other in a totemized form is a potential prospect for divinizing these totems. So in its earliest form, it's going to represent the axis of the earth, which is the pole, and the southern pole being the primary because that's where it starts, and then the northern pole prospect where it culminates. And then the equinox, the center point between the two, as a shoe raising of the horizon, but also as a partition. So the double Horus of the double Hermacus, or Horus Behutet, which is God of the hut or God of the axe, is a contingency. So that's one thing I want to say. Is in each phase of these hero cults. So we have three phases, which we say correspond to the three degrees of masonry, which corresponds to the story of the natural human development in three phases, which is infancy, adolescence, and maturity. and the maturity concerning mastery over the masculine principle, but also the eschatology, which is final things. Each stage of this nature cults and these hero cults is in three phases. So the beginning, the middle, and the end, or the early, middle, late phases of each cult. So the idea of understanding the last phase of the stellar is going to be better understood by understanding the early phases of the lunar and how it's being brought forward. And in the lunar, we have Kensu, which is winged in a cross-wing pattern that typifies the symbol of the X. But it's also it's a preservation of carrying that middle partition of Horus Behutet, which is that middle phase of the stellar fault corresponding to the equinoctial hemispheres of south and north. But it's also a contingency for polarization, because it's all going to be stored in the north. So the prospect for polarization and to a masculine imbalance is there. And I know that's hard for people to understand, but I just want to make sure and say it and get it on the table. But Kensu in the lunar phase is a representation of harmonizing both of these equinoctial hemispheres into one. So it's a contingency, or it's an extension, or a new form, a type of the Horus Behutet in double X. So let's talk about Gavel for a minute. So, you know, first they store in symbol, and then they store in astronomy, cosmology, and then they built the pyramids, which are a ritual of the seven in stone. So they're preserving it in the seven, but the seven is carrying the five, and it's carrying the original stellar trinity in the three, which is Horus, Sut, and Shu, and that corresponding to the three pillars. So the poles in their pure forms, they represent these equinoctial divisions of the hemispheres, south and north. Because the idea is, once we separate these divine prospects of God of the South Pole, God of the North Pole, then they go to war with each other. And then the spiritual prospect, which corresponds to the spirit realm, night, sky, and darkness, becomes marginalized and stigmatized, and that becomes justification for man's authority and materialism as the highest prospect. And I know that's very confusing for people, but let me just say this. That first, it's preserved in symbol. So the lost symbol is Gavel, which is three sticks crossed. The center vertical stick would represent that pole. And then it's carrying the X, which represents that five. And then in Kensu, we see that in the split wing of Kensu carrying that symbol of the X forward. And then by the time we get to the early solar phase, we have to understand that there's no anthropomorphization before the solar cult. And that when we get to the solar phase, we're beginning in the nine, because the seven is the primary concern in the lesser mysteries and the pure forms, and that the symbol or the convention of Ta is a contingency to bring all of the zoo typology into a prospect for a humanized form, but all deities brought into one. So you can see they have this concern about, number one, divinizing the masculine too soon, and also they have a concern about anthropomorphizing their sign language representation, totemic representation of elemental powers, because they have a good understanding of how this is going to be corrupted if it's not meticulously cared for and planned forward. So everything that they're doing is concerning their prospect for a future civilization and how the knowledge is going to continue to unfold. And they're, you know, it's demonstrating that they're aware that the eschatology and the mastery over the masculine principle is concerning the third degree and the final stage of the full development of the sacred science. So Ta, at the beginning of the solar phase, is the father of the eight, so to speak, because he represents the nine. And that nine is preserved in those Mexican pyramids. So the Mexican pyramids in nine represent the little bear, Ursa Minor, and the sun and the moon. But the nine is the last single digit before we go into double digits, which is the 10, which is the one and the zero, the phallus and the egg. The 10 represents a prospect for greater mysteries. And that's always been, in my view, represented in the Aten. And the cult of Aten exists in the stellar phase. But what does that mean? That means those are the high speculative priest class, and they're only privy to this higher knowledge of Osiris. And that we have evidence in Laplanjan's excavations in Yucatan at Uxmal. In the temples, they had the one ashlar, or the form of the triangle on top of the square. And in the one, it has the stars at the three corners at the triangle. And then in the other, it has the five stars at the center of the triangle, which represent the family of Osiris, which is the gods of the four corners, with Osiris at the center. And, you know, this is actually the full unfoldment of these early forms. It's a difficult thing to explain, but let me just say that what's preserved in the gavel is these seven points of these three sticks cross, the six exterior points and one at the center, but that center axis is the pole. So it primarily represents the two pillars of north and south, but all dualities. Because the whole, you start to realize everything they're trying to do is harmonize the duality of physical existence and understanding that the spiritual prospect is singular. Even though it's venerated in a dual motherhood, that represents a physical versus a spiritual prospect, which is happening in the same place at the same time. So the symbol of Bes, which is at the end of the lunar phase, ushering in the solar phase, is a symbol of transformation. And it's a symbol of nothing anthropomorphized up to the beginning of the solar phase. And it represents the elder Horus, which is stellar, which comes before the younger Horus, which is solar, which is a new prospect. So we're talking about the first advent of Horus,
which is in stellar.
And all his different forms begins in the stellar phase. Hmm. And then, you know, the complexities and perplexities begin when they start to change forms and change types. Then when they become anthropomorphized, we are in a really dangerous prospect, because then that we have to deal with the phenomenon of this euhemerizing and literalizing and historicizing expressions of symbolism and sign language. So they understand, you know, part of what I'm saying is that this is the evidence that the pyramid builders understood what was to follow. They understood that venerating in annual cycles had the potential to corrupt their timekeeping, and why Horus and the salvation prospect comes in the stellar phase in the inundation. So the Sebek Horus, which is Horus the fish, changes types after that. But it's preserved in the pure form of Sebek Horus in the fish, which typifies the inundation in the Nile Valley when the Nile floods its banks and replenishes and rejuvenates the land with the fluvian soil of fertility, is where we get the term black land, which is where we get the term chem. But the main thing I'm saying is that Horus Behute or Horus Sebek in the form of fish is typical of the inundation. And that part of what that's telling us is that they are not only not venerating in annual cycles, that they understand the danger of it, because their timekeeping is concerning the great year procession, not procession, but succession of the seven circumpolar stars in the northern circumpolar constellations, which takes place over roughly 26,000 years, 25,827 years. And there's seven successive shifts of the North Star, which is Polaris in all of its phases, happening roughly every 3,600 years. But each time that shift takes place represents a deluge, and then commencement of the entire cycle is the Great Deluge. So each prospect of the deluge is a prospect for knowledge to become corrupted and lost. And that's where we get the idea of the great flood, because it's flooded over with this colossal ignorance in the waters of space. You know, so if we don't know where the cycle begins, then we can't restore it back into its pure form and understand that their timekeeping concerns these long epochs. That's why they're able to keep this long record of this time, and they understand that how the annual, you know, venerating in annual cycles and man's ambition to put a finer point on time potentially could and will and ultimately does corrupt their methods of timekeeping. So the solar priest class, they are deficient in the knowledge of the astronomical cycle to make the calculations to correct that cycle. And then as a result, we lose all of those epochs, which represent 26,000 years. And we there is evidence that they've, you know, recorded at least 11 epochs. So multiply 11 by 26,000. And that's part of, you know, a record of the human story. And that's a different subject. But I want to get back to talking about this unfoldment of the symbolism. So from Gavel, They move the seven points of the gavel into double axe, and the double axe is Horus Behute as a symbol of the double power, which is a symbol of the double horizon in the equinoctial hemispheres. And then they store that into the seven and the Ursa Minor, and then build the pyramids. So Ptah at the beginning of the solar phase represents bringing all of the types, including both sexes, both genders, and all dualities harmonized into one deity. Well, all the elemental powers combined is the best way to say it. So Ptah in the nine is a symbol of all the elemental powers combined. So we can understand how that becomes monotheistic and a sky daddy prospect in the anthropomorphized phase. So go ahead and we'll work off of that, because it's hard to say. And I've mentioned some of the things I wanted to say, but I got to take a step back and we can get a little bit deeper into this. Go ahead.
Beautifully said. I definitely was following everything that you were just saying there. I really, really like the way that you're tying this all together, especially working your way up from the beginning of the gavel and working your way forward into Horus in the lunar and on into, you know, how that stores the five. I've thought about this too in another way, in the sense that the if Osiris is the X, which Osiris is the X, then moving, you know, through the stellar, you know, passed down from the stellar into the lunar, into the light of the lunar, it is, it's dual in the sense of, you know, light and dark. But you're taking the light of the five being passed, or the seven being passed into the lunar. And then, in the solar, ritual of Osiris, when Osiris is going from the new moon, or from the full moon, to the, you know, where he's chopped up into 14 phases.
Yeah, so it's the duality of waxing and waning angles in annual cycles as man's ambition to put a finer point on time.
Right.
So go ahead.
Well, yeah, and yeah, well said. And then, and so the way that I'm also seeing this too is that man has forgotten how to look at the moonlight as stellar light and solar light combined, and know how to look at both as different forms of light, because one is literal, okay, the exoteric, and the other one is allegorical. It preserves the great year cycle. It preserves the mythos, and so you know, this is where, so the moon is part of understanding where the confusion takes place, because it goes, you know, the stellar light gets passed into the lunar. The lunar is holding the stellar, and then that's what goes into the solar. Without this is where we start to lose the stellar. We start to lose the stellar light because it's not being preserved correctly. So this is again, this is preserved. I see this preserved in the solar with the ritual of Osiris.
That's what the ambition is. That's what I'm trying to clarify. So all elemental power is stored into one divinity in Ta, and Ta being the father of the eight, therefore his successor, Amen-Ra, is the father of the nine and the ten. So the ten brings forward the full prospect of Aten. Mm. In the disc, which is now solar.
That's right.
And the five doubled arrives us at the 10, and the 10 signifies greater mysteries, which signifies complex forms. And then from the 10, it's fully unfolded into the 12, which we find in all things 12. And the solar doctrines. So the significant numbers are the 7 and the 12, because the 7 is stellar in pure forms, and the 12 is solar in the third degree, final stage of maturity, in complex forms that we have to take responsibility for. So everything that they're endeavoring to do is to preserve it and consolidate it without corrupting it. So in that, we can better understand their culture by understanding what they're endeavoring to do, and understand that this fish symbolism was a genius stroke, because the venerating in the inundation, rather than in the annual cycles of the solar and the lunar, allows us to trace that fish symbolism all the way through into modern Christianity, where they're exhibiting the mitre. And it's a corrupted, deteriorated form of the Sebek Horus, which goes all the way back to the middle to the late stages of the stellar phase, you know, and potentially allows us to tear down that partition of Horus Behutet as a contingency, and take responsibility for the totality of the unfoldment, and understand this sacred trace of how to take it back. And boy, that was a mouthful. That was hard to say, but there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, you're
and
you're right on, man. When it comes to the fish symbolism and as the mitre, that's a huge deal. And I'm gonna get more into that here in the next few shows, but that really is very significant because it really is preserving this science, but of course in a very manifested deteriorated form, you know, in an anthropomorphized you know, an actualized person, you know, these people, these popes, these priests.
Yeah, and then it begins to be romanced and then, you know, romanticized, humanized, characterized, and then literalized and historicized.
Right. That's right. And that's so we're seeing it happen right before our eyes. And it's a really big deal. Really big deal. But I really like, you know, what you're talking about with the way that this is being held back. And you know, this Aten, you know, this is something that, you know, I'm still trying to understand, but you know, if you could just explain that more in the sense of,
yeah,
of pentacle and you know, coin, you know, this is a really big deal.
Okay, well, the Aten is represented by the disc, which corresponds to the sun. It, of course, you know, the circle has always been considered the divine form, without beginning, without end. The Bora is the snake eating its tail, is the eternal soul. It's a symbol of eternity in itself, but it's also an eternal prospect for divinity and singularity in that respect, or you know, not only the acknowledgement that the spiritual and the physical are happening in the same place at the same time, but the unification of that prospect. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the eschatology, that the five had always been, from its very beginning, a prospect for the eschatology, which they understood would be the last phase. And that Osiris would be erected and divinized in that phase. What am I trying to say? Yeah. So the eschatologically, in the five, it represents the five holy days, which are the end of the old year into the beginning of the new year. So the final things in the year cycle are typified by the five, and that's eschatological. However, in the solar doctrine, Osiris is typified as a mummy, breathless and lifeless. So the sun's first move one degree northward is the beginning of the waxing angles. And there we have the X, surprisingly, in the word waxing. But that first degree movement north is the prospect for the eternal soul, the resurrection, and that's Amsu Horus. And Amsu Horus also typifies Horus as the sayer of sayings in the underworld or the spiritual realm, whereas Iu-Mhetep is Horus, the child of 12, which is the sayer of sayings to men in the terrestrial prospect. That's a hard thing to understand, but I'm trying to get it on the table so we can deal with it. But there's more to the Amsu Horus, and I wanted to mention that the Sebek Horus is transferred over into crocodile. And so when we see Horus in an anthropomorphized form on two crocodiles, we have to understand that that's a solar prospect trying to bring forth from the stellar and bring the stellar forward or preserve it in Sebek Horus. And that the crocodile if we look at a crocodile in the water, we see its tail, its middle back, and then its head. And those three things that we can see, they typify Sut in the tail, and then the equator, or the middle, and then Horus in the head. Mm. So Sut in the tail, the equator in the middle, or Shu in the middle. Yeah, that's right. The raising of the horizon, the linear prospect raised into 3D, but then Horus in the head. But it's Sebek Horus. It's a new type. It's a new totem of Horus, or a prospect for Horus in his maturity. And it gets confusing because the elder Horus is the pure form and stellar. And then Horus the younger is the new. So the first advent of Horus is in the stellar phase. And what signifies or distinguishes that is there's no anthropomorphization, but that Horus evolves through many different types all the way into the modern world. But as I said, the Horus symbol being one of the last types, and that's a contingency to really trace it back from, you know, the outer world of, ultimately through Britain is what I'm going to tell you, because through that we can connect back to Chaldea in pre-Roman Britain, which is difficult work, but I'm telling you, I've looked at it enough. Start reading the Harold Bailey and you start realizing how difficult that stuff is. But let me make that point is Horus in the second advent, or in the first advent, is pre-anthropomorphized. So the second advent happens, the first advent of Horus happens in the stellar phase. But the second advent does not happen until the solar phase. So that's interceded by the lunar phase. And that's confusing, I know. But the second advent of Horus can be distinguished in the solar phase, because that's when the phenomenon of anthropomorphizing begins to take place. So we should think of anthropomorphizing as complex forms of totemism.
Right.
And that's a difficult thing to understand, because, you know what I mean? It's a human representation of elemental powers has a prospect to create a god complex. It has a prospect to slide into man's the ultimate authority and give all the glory to man, depriving the true one great spirit.
Yeah, it's definitely for the mature only.
Of the glory, I'm sorry.
Definitely for the mature only. It's not for the immature, because as you can see, the immature have gotten a hold of it, and now you see the world we live in. And what do you mean? Like, what? How would you further define this term advent when it comes to Horus?
Well, the convention.
Okay.
You know, the advent, the phenomenon of the convention of, you know, the origin of religion, and then the expression, it's a science in the sense of it's a prospect to understand these hidden forces in nature. But by revering and venerating these forces, that's a means of preserving the knowledge. And then the sign language is a means of passing the knowledge forward and preserving and communicating the knowledge. So we have the greatest body of science that was ever developed attempting to be communicated and passed forward and preserved, but also the expression. So it's you know, the dilemma in the modern world is we don't understand the science and we don't understand the expression of the science. This is why the Hebrews and Greeks really didn't have access to it, because they didn't understand the expression. And as we can see, it's very easy to see why this became so obscured, because these are hard things to understand, and our thinking process has changed also, as you know, as a result of alphabetizing and symbols, you know, and all the symbols of the alphabet, for instance, have been reduced to nothing more than a phonetic variant. And they once carried, you know, tremendous amounts of knowledge. But I kind of want to start talking a little bit about the eschatology, because I just generally wanted to say that with the five as eschatological prospect in its earliest phase of the five is the five holy days, the five epigominal days, to denote the beginning of the new year. So we have to understand what creates all the ambiguity about the when the new year starts, and it has a lot to do with when to plant, when to harvest. If we move into the north away from the equator, then the planting season could be moved farther into the year, and then that could be associated with a new year, and then we lose or have the prospect or potential to lose the prospect of the new year typified by the sun at its southernmost destination. And that's why we have to anchor to it there at the winter solstice. And the five epigominal days are eschatological in that sense, but it's also eschatological in the prospect for the development of the mythos. So eschatologically, from what I can understand, it's a prospect for eschatology, which they know will be the final stage in the stellar phase. They know it's a prospect which will arrive in the solar phase. And the more we understand that, the more we can understand that this ancient stellar class understood the profundities of what was to come in the future civilization, but they also understood the dangers of these corruptions and these prospects. So, for instance, in the lunar phase, it becomes pretty clear to see that this is where the myth of Osiris and this dismemberment takes place, because of the waxing and waning cycles of the moon. They divide the moon up into different aspects, with the full moon representing the whole aspect remembered or reassembled into the whole form. And then as it wanes back in and starts to chop it up, that becomes a symbol of dismemberment. So that Osirian myth concerning dismemberment is, you know, it's coming from that lunar phase of the eschatology. But that eschatological prospect cannot be perfected until the solar phase and the full unfoldment of the mysteries in the 12, when the zodiac is completed. Because in the 12, because that final stage is the descent from the autumn equinox into the, you know, the winter solstice, or the underworld. So the autumn. Let me see what else I can bring about this Atum, because it comes from Tem, which was the serpent. And that's interesting, because that's in the word totem. So the serpent has the potential to be one of the earliest prospects that predates all of this stuff. The tomb Amen is coming out of the lunar phase, or the Atum is coming out of the lunar phase and ushering in Ta.
When you say Ta, you're saying Ptah, right? Or just Ta?
Yeah, that's Ptah, which I would tell you is really a contingency for single axe as a symbol of primacy in the north, followed by double axe, which comes first. And that's a huge contingency. And then all of the vowel sounds are the ineffable name. The vowel, so the consonants typify the physical realm, while the vowels typify the spirit. And
that's really interesting, because I want to just interject something real quick that I just noticed, is that when you look at the Kairu, and this is the X overlapping the line with the P symbol, right?
And, that's right.
And this is, you know, originally this is a monogram for Osiris, but what I just realized is that when you say Mexico, a lot of Mexicans say Mexico, so they leave out the sound of the X.
And yeah, and that's disturbing. Yeah, that is. Yeah, but it could be looked at as they're preserving it. But
right, but when you say Ta and you don't say the P, it's interesting, because you have the Pata, the P, and then you have the X of the, you know, Mexico or Uxmal. And even Uxmal, they pronounce it Ushmal, which is very interesting. So, you know, this X being kind of almost X'd out of the sound is very strange. But yeah, you might be right. They might be preserving it. But also the fact that, you know, the with everything you're saying, the way it connects with that silent X and that silent P, you know, that has an interesting connection there.
It's a serious concern, and I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, Mexico is difficult to deal with. And, you know, that's a real concern, because we've already talked about, you know, Laplanjian's excavations at Uxmal in the Yucatan. And I want to get more into that. I was hoping to get more into that, but let me just kind of stay where I'm at right now, because I want to demonstrate this corrupted form and these Jehovah doctrines. Horus and the solar cult, first name Tum, or Nefer Atum, or Atum Iu, or Aten, or Keper, and which is a symbol of eternal rejuvenation. Zoo type form only in the stellar and lunar phases. Father Atum was Ra in his first sovereignty. Atum was born as Horus or Iu, child of the mother, and afterwards was depicted as Atum Ra, as God the Father. So the Atum and the Jehovah distortion is Adam. And Adam having dominion over all of the animals is the prospect for anthropomorphization as Ta, combining all elemental powers into one. So this distortion of Adam having dominion over the animals is really about the divine symbol of Ta taking precedence over zoo typology coming out of totemic sociology.
Mm. Wow.
Okay. That's a very difficult thing to understand, and it's hard to say, but I'm glad I finally got it on the table, because that's one of the things that I wanted to really get on the table today. Mm. One thing that's significant about the Aten is that we can find evidence of it in all three phases of the hero cults. So Aten in the later phases is a revival in a sense, which did occur under Tutankhamun and ultimately Akhenaten, but they were short-lived and limited to a pretty localized region and short-lived in that respect. But see, the corruption, in my view, of the Aten is a failure to take responsibility for the masculine prospect, which corresponds to failure to take responsibility for complex forms and the mastery over the masculine and complex forms and anthropomorphized forms of Horus in the second advent. So I hope I was thorough in explaining the difference between the first and second advent of Horus. So remember, the first advent of Horus takes place in the stellar cult, and that everything up to the end of the lunar cult is pre-anthropomorphic. So the anthropomorphization only takes place in the solar phase, and that's when the eschatology is perfected. So that's the second advent of Horus in the solar phase. So the first advent takes place in the stellar phase, the earliest phase, and then the second advent takes place in the solar phase, which can be distinguished by the anthropomorphization of typology in the sign language and the expression.
Yeah, I really like what you're saying about the Aten. This is really a big deal and something that I really wanted to cover more, that I've been thinking about, just a, like a correspondence, because you're talking about how the Aten is preserving a way for us to understand how to, you know, reconnect and overcome this masculine prospect, right? To master the masculine prospect.
Yeah.
And I find it very interesting because as we have slid into socialism and we have, you know, when you're talking about the pentacle of Aten, the five, but, you know, as a coin, I find it very interesting.
Material prospect is what I mean by that. Yeah.
Yeah. Material prospect and
a masculine imbalance.
Right. And so what I'm seeing though, just as a symbol, because when we're talking about the Aten and we're also talking about, you know, Osiris with the four gods, the four corners supporting the middle point being the spirit, the animistic component. This is when you look at the dollar bill, what do you see? You see a president, especially on the $1 bill. It's very interesting because when you think of George Washington being associated as a, you know, a Freemason, it's very interesting. He has the four corners being 1, 1, 1, 1, and then he is at the center. Right.
That's right.
And so,
that's,
you know, right. This is that, you know, Mon Eye, the proxy one eye. It's even green, you know, like Osiris.
Yeah. That's right.
And so plus it's also rectangular too. That's also very important because that
square
corresponds. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. But either way, you have four corners. But then, you know, think about coin and you have someone's head on a coin. You know, it's, you think about the circle dot as well. You know, they're right at the
that's
center.
Right. Yep.
And, you know, this is all about...
It's man trying to usurp the place of the creator and take all the glory for himself.
That's right.
So he can be the arbiter of truth and neglect, you know, and negate responsibility and, you know, basically subjugate humanity.
Absolutely.
To his authority.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so you have the circle and the square. That we're constantly using as a form of exchange. Now it's going into full on, you know, digitalized. So it's even more complex.
Yeah. And, you know, to further explain elemental powers, the forces in nature that are not man-made and unseen forces. So it typifies occult, you know, hidden typifies occult. The hidden forces in nature, the natural law, the elemental powers. I want to further demonstrate that are basically should start with light and dark. And the, you know, the dual nature of physical existence. And that the prospect to harmonize these things. So elemental powers in basic forms are could be understood as should start with light and dark, but correspond that to enlightenment or educated, and darkness representing ignorance and light representing illuminated or educated properly. But the elemental powers themselves, light and dark, and then phenomenon of weather, darkness, and drought, how these became turned into ethnical personages and glorified as national heroes. And, you know, this is exactly what you were talking about with the symbol on the money. So elemental powers, you know, could entail storm, but storm can be broken down into more distinguished forms. You know, storm could contain rain, wind, drought, which is lack of rain, you know, hurricane, tornado, any powers in nature that are not man-made and greater than man and inherent in the natural world. The wars of Horus were fought in heaven and Amenta against Sabal the dragon, the serpent, and as Horus. Orion was one of the great stellar figures. I'm reading a little bit here. And this, as Egyptian, was Horus as Heru. So Heru is where we get the word hero. This word signifies chief. The one is overlord, the ruler, the mighty one. The hero, as Heru or Horus, was originally a stellar image. He was the annual bringer of food and drink before there was a sun god imaged, and when the stars were the annunciators of the coming time and the seasons. So this then afterwards was made solar and then eschatological. So in the eschatology, as I said, the five was typifying the eschatology of the annual cycle, with the five holy days preserving the winter solstice and to store the 365 degree phenomenon of a solar annual cycle into a 360 degree perfect circle. So these 5 days were mystical in that respect, and sabbatical in a certain respect. You know, they were meant to be venerated as a means of preserving the knowledge and preserving pure forms. But we follow that forward through the lunar, and as we said, we can see how this dismemberment phenomenon starts to materialize, which we find when we study the mystery of Osiris. And this phenomenon of this dismemberment, we can relate that to these waxing and waning angles of the lunar, and how the sun or the moon restores itself into a full aspect and then dismembers itself into fragmented forms. And then coming into the early solar cult, it's the followers of Horus that begin to extend the eschatology into originally a solar prospect concerning the Great Bear, which is seven. The Big Dipper, the Big Bear, dropping below the horizon from the perspective of the northern hemisphere, and how that represents symbolically the descent into Amenta, or the underworld, before it was attached to the solar phenomenon of the annual season and the sun going into its waning aspects and the daily cycle of night and day. So the night typifies the descent into the underworld and is renewed daily, resurrected daily. So I wanted to point that out, that's what the perfection of the eschatology is concerning, is how it's ultimately preserved in the day cycle and the annual cycle of the solar aspect. But that the original prospect was south to north. So Sut was primary deity, ultimately deposed with Horus as the god of the North Pole to typify Most High, but that we need to remember that it's the same deity in its northern aspect, and Sut is primary deity, and that the early forms are pre-anthropomorphic. So the first advent combined with the second advent of Horus is how we can tear down that partition of Horus Behutet as partition and acts as god of the double horizon, as the early secret society sect to preserve pure forms. And I know that's hard to understand, but that's basically how I wanted to explain that. And then in Kensu, it's important to study Kensu in the lunar phase, because that evidences how the old forms are brought forward into the new phase of the evolution of the hero cult. So a study of Kensu is very important to understand how the forms are brought on into the later phases of the hero cult, and understand that the first advent of Horus all the way up to the end of the lunar cult is pre-anthropomorphic, and that Ta combines all these elemental representations into one form, and potentially beginning to take on the humanized forms of anthropomorphic, and then succeeded by Amen-Ra is the full splendor of the development of this mythos and this early knowledge. Yeah, and Amen-Ra is the creator or the father of the nine, so the father of Ta. It signifies the second advent of Horus. And it's still, you know, the Amen-Ra, the cult of Amen-Ra takes place before the cult of Osiris, which is basically kind of a return to the night sky, or the underworld, corresponding to the solar cycles. That's hard to explain and hard to understand, but it's basically typifying a maturity, or, you know, entrance into the third degree, what I'm trying to say. But anyway, that the greater mysteries are originally in 10. So when we're talking about the A-10, we are concerning the 10, which is the 5 doubled, which is partially, you know, carrying the prospect for the eschatology and the prospect for perfection of eschatology and the future civilizations to come in the later phases of the evolution of the mythos and these hero cults. So it's important to understand that the greater mysteries are originally in the 10, and then ultimately unfolded into the full splendor of the 12 in the zodiac.
What doubles the 5? Because you said
the Aten is the 5 doubled.
I know, but what doubles it?
So that takes us into double digits.
I see.
But the 5 times 2 is the 5 doubled.
But I'm just trying to get to where the 2 is.
So
no,
Osiris
I know,
is the 5 doubled. So in that way, I see the Aten as you know, the high speculative priest class bringing forward that mystery of Osiris for further unfoldment in the eschatology. It's a prospect for eschatology, but see, it also represents powers of 10, which unlocks the key for man to wield forces of nature and modern technology. So the prospect for the spiritual prospect is compromised for utility and man's ambition to develop technology. And I know that's difficult, but I wanted to say it because I want to get it on the table. You can see I'm struggling a little with it, but never mind that. I mean, it's important because Most important thing to remember what I'm saying right now is that the greater mysteries are first in the 10. They are in 10, but they unfold into the 12. So the most significant numerology that we are concerned with is the 7, which is the stellar, and then the 12 in the solar, which represents complex forms. And that the 17 gnomes that were built in Egypt were built to typify that the original greater mysteries were in the 10. So the 17 carries the 7 lesser mysteries and then the 10 greater mysteries, which are unfolded into the 12. That's what I was trying to say. I know it's a mouthful, but yeah, I think we should probably consider starting to wind it down because I've pretty much gotten everything I wanted to on the table at least. And, you know, these are very difficult subjects. So rather than try to further confound them, maybe humble ourselves in the sense that this is kind of where we are. And we got plenty of food for thought here to go forward with. So,
this is a good spot to go ahead and wind it down. And if there's anything else that you would like to say before we get off here, any last words and or what you got going on, you know, want to talk about your shows that you've done, please feel free.
Well, yeah, we got a lot of this stuff on the table, which was our ambition for today. And we can further flesh this out, hopefully on a future show. And we'll try to get more into the detail and start presenting all of these different types, because that's part of the confusion. I think when you're studying the pantheon of the Egyptian, you have to understand. I mean, I want you to focus on the primary forms, which is, you know, basically the stellar trinity, which is Horus, Sut, and Shu, and then ultimately the family of Osiris, which is the house of Anup or the four corners, and it's pure animism with Osiris at the center. But I'm just basically saying that those are the primary figures. And then everything else that comes after that is like, you know, breaking down into their elemental powers into finer elements. And then it creates a large pantheon of Egyptian deities that's confused with polytheism. And how monotheism is a dangerous prospect. And, you know, as it's a phenomenon of anthropomorphizing these forms. So, you know, we have to understand that totemism is important to understand how this corruption takes place. But, you know, we got a lot on the table today, so I'm happy about that. You know, I thought maybe I could explain some of these things a little better, but if we take a step back now, we'll know where we need to address some of these difficult ideas and concepts, and there's plenty of food for thought, you know, on today's show. And as far as what I'm doing, you know, I recently did the show with Francesco Sani and Ivan Oyola Jr., which is basically just a extensive soundtrack show where we talk about film soundtracks and cinematic aspects, elements of cinema, and how it is, you know, part of cinema. And it's partly entertaining and partly educational, but mostly, you know, it's just you know, dealing with cinema soundtracks. And it's just a really cool show that Francesco and Ivan came up with. And we've done the fifth one now, and this one is the longest one. It was almost 18 hours. And so that just came out. And then I just went on a show with Chris Jansen on the End Evil podcast. And Chris Jansen and I had a pretty interesting discussion. And we were getting into the sacred masculine principles and talked a little bit about this kind of stuff. But yeah, I'm really happy to be back on the cubbyhole with you, Nate. You've been doing a great job. So I really have nothing but respect for all of your hard work. And it makes it possible for us to get into these deeper aspects and put a finer point on some of these difficult subjects. So, I really appreciate all your efforts and all your hard work. And it's a real honor to be back on here and excited about what we got on the table today, you know. So we got a lot to work with, and I'll look forward to coming back on and trying to further flesh this out and not try to further confound people, because I realize how difficult this stuff is. You know, I did want to say that if you're studying the church word, or when you get to the church word, remember that there's 7 books, and that's cryptic. And that in the first publication, for Church Word's first publication, The Origin and Antiquity of Freemasonry, is 1898, and it only has 72 pages. And then the second edition of Origin and Antiquity, which I have both copies, has 75 pages. And as we just talked about, the most significant numbers are the 7 and the 12. And I wanted to just use that as a way to demonstrate how some of these church word books are cryptic. In the page 72, the Gematria gives you the 9, which we just talked about in the Ta, and the 9 pyramids of Mexico. And then the 75, which is the second edition, is a cryptic indicator of the full unfoldment of the greater mysteries, going into double digits, and added together in the Gematria yields us the 12, which in the Gematria restores us back to the original Trinity in the 3.
Right.
So anyway, that's probably a good place to leave it off. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come on here with you, Nate. And I love all your work and much respect for all your efforts. So thank you for having me on, and I'll look forward to seeing you again in the very near future.
Well, the feeling's mutual. I really respect you and all your efforts and your effort to make it back on here again. So recent, and I really appreciate the way that we were able to get together again and lay this all out. And it's, I'm telling you, to say this work is very difficult is such an understatement. And but here we are. We're doing our best to put it on the table, and we're making the effort. And that's really what it takes. It takes a great deal of care. And, I wanted to say, I haven't got a chance to see your show with Francesco and Ivan yet, but
there's nothing to see. It's just 17 hours of soundtracks.
Yeah. Well, I want to make it through that, because I know there's little kernels of conversations that you guys have that are really cool when you guys do those videos. But I watched the show that you did with Chris, and it was amazing. I really, really enjoyed that show. I've already seen it twice. I've been studying it. And I will put a link up in the description for that show and Francesco and Ivan's show as well. So that being said, I do have I'm going to do a solo show, possibly. Maybe I'll have Doug back on again for the next show, but definitely in the near future, just to continue to trace out this information and put this arcane knowledge on the table so we can sort it out. But I am going to get into the sacred trace and orienting on the next show, and just really dive deeply into that and really show people just how important it is to understand these concepts. And that being said, I really appreciate everybody that's made it this far. If you're listening to this show, if you want to, if you're interested in more episodes or presentations or news, you can go to cubbyhole.com. Also, if you have any questions regarding anything that you've heard on this show or other shows, you can email me at cubbyhole@mail.com. And, you know, that's basically it. So I'm your host, Nate Kapp, and thank you for listening. And keep in mind to do no harm, defend truth, and keep transcending dogma.